One of the peculiar results of electric information movement is decentralism. Whereas railways and older forms of communication favored highly centralized structures, socially, politically, electric systems of information favor complete decentralism, because such is the...
Marshall McLuhan's global village is reality. We're plugged in electronically to the remotest parts of the planet. Culture, sports, and politics are being globalized, and the underlying force is economics.
The Asian economic crisis has been swift and dramatic. Some countries are looking beyond their borders for help. Take South Korea. Its economy is one of the biggest in Asia, behind Japan and China. Today, South Korea asked the International Monetary Fund for...
Most of us think in terms of national powers, like Britain, the United States, or Russia. They were powerful because they controlled vast amounts of the world's wealth. They could both command armies and offer incentives in terms of aid or trade. But today, wealth and power are no longer the exclusive prerogative of the nation-state. Now, those powers are increasingly exercised by private corporations. The change has been revolutionary.
Well, let's take the 100 biggest economies in the world now. If you compare countries with companies, this year, 51 of the biggest economies in the world are corporations, only 49 are countries. And that means, for example, that the big companies, Mitsubishi, Mitsui, the giant Japanese trading companies, are bigger than Denmark or Thailand or Indonesia. Toyota and Royal Dutch Shell are bigger than Norway. Exxon is bigger than Finland. Walmart is bigger than Poland. These are economic entities of the size and power that is unequaled in the history of the world.
That's John Cavanagh, author of a book called Global Dreams and co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. It's a think tank that looks at how national and international policies affect the lives of people around the world. Cavanagh says that today's global corporations grew beyond their national borders because it was the only way to make bigger profits.
If you go around the world, for example, and spend time in Africa or Asia, you will find those markets inundated with Heineken beer, Guinness, and Tuborg. These are beers which all come from small European countries, Heineken from the Netherlands, Guinness from Ireland, and Tuborg from Denmark. They all, over 25 years ago, had saturated their local market, and by nature of the corporate need to expand or die, they went overseas. All of those companies are now global companies. The same is true of Coca-Cola. It's a company that's over 100 years old. They're basically selling Americans. Americans are saturated with Coke. You'd be hard-pressed to get people to drink any more Coca-Cola. But the Chinese market isn't saturated with Coke, nor is the Indonesian market. And so most large companies, even in big dynamic markets like the United States, in order to be profitable, have gone overseas.
This is a fairly recent phenomenon. We know that there are huge corporations out there, but basically we believe that national governments, especially the United States, still call the shots. John Cavanagh.
For much of the Cold War period, 1945 to 1990, the growing power of these global corporations was obscured by the superpower rivalry and by the dominant political and economic force of the United States in global markets and in world politics. With the end of the Cold War and with the shift from what we might call the age of national security to the age of globalization, I think more and more people are aware of the fact that the true economic powers in the world is no longer the United States per se, but is this phalanx of 200 large companies whose sales are the equivalent of over a quarter of global economic activity. It is these entities which more and more determine the working conditions, the health conditions, the environmental conditions of people around the world.
The 200 largest companies in the world employ less than one-third of 1% of the global workforce. But they control nearly 30% of the world's wealth. How did so much power and wealth become corporate instead of national? Jerry Mander heads both the International Forum on Globalization and the Foundation for Deep Ecology in San Francisco. He says the idea of a global economy is usually portrayed as a natural outgrowth of modern progress. Globalization is seen as something that's not only positive, but inevitable.
It tends to be described as something that kind of evolved, as though it was some sort of force of nature. But that's wrong. As technology advances and as institutions get larger and larger, they're operating more globally. And it's not an accident, and it's not just a natural evolutionary process. It really is a designed system set up for the specific purposes of rationalizing that corporations should basically make the rules of economic activity globally, that they're the logical, rational system to do that.
This means that globalization didn't just grow like Topsy. It was deliberately designed, and it's been in the works for a long time. Jerry Mander.
Now, this global economic design really was in the minds of economists probably in the 20s and 30s for the most part, but really came into fruition at the Bretton Woods meetings at the end of the Second World War in the United States, where the leading economists, corporate CEOs and government leaders got together coming out of a Second World War. There had been tremendous devastation, and they were trying to figure out how to design a world economy in the wake of all this horror and devastation. I think they thought of themselves as do-gooders at the time, and they were trying to think of what kind of system would prevent such terrible things from happening again. And they designed a system. The best system that they could come up with was one in which accelerated economic development everywhere in the world, which believed that economic development was the final answer to people's problems. So it accelerated free trade, eliminated the rules that countries use to control economic activity, put real power in the hands of large corporations via such institutions as the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and put all countries in the same economic system and create rules that all these countries must follow. And the purpose of these rules is to free up corporate and financial activity so that it can be unfettered to use up the last resources, find cheap labor, and operate globally without any interference.
In the aftermath of World War II, the new monetary organizations, the World Bank and the IMF, were impressively successful in restoring the economies of war-ravaged countries. With Europe and Japan recovered, these institutions turned to the Third World. Their poverty, it was believed, would be conquered by greater trade and economic growth. Wealth was expected to trickle down through all sectors of society and the global community. Donald Johnston is the Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD. It's made up of 29 of the world's richest industrialized countries. It was founded after World War II to monitor and encourage trade in the interests of peace and stability. Today, it's the leading voice for the benefits of economic globalization. As the Secretary General of the OECD, Donald Johnston has a very clear idea about what a global economy is.
A global economy is really based on the principle that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. Clearly, as we've expanded from local village economies to regional economies to provincial economies to national economies, there has been ever greater economic growth, more opportunities, and increased standards of living. Now, governments have the responsibility to be able to transfer the benefits of that growth to society as a whole. But what has happened nationally in many of our countries must now happen internationally, where there are many economies which, of course, have not been brought into the mainstream of world prosperity. 1.2 to 3 billion people still living on less than a dollar a day. Another 800 million or so living on less than $2 a day. Clearly, the benefits of a global economy will be such as they are in a national economy, but the distribution of those benefits is the great challenge for statesmanship as we enter the 21st century.
Canada's first foray into the new global economy was the Free Trade Agreement with the United States. Following that, we signed NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which brought Mexico into our economic circle. Opinions are mixed about how beneficial it's been. Donald Johnston thinks it's been a resounding success.
Well, the numbers are certainly very impressive. The trade in North America has increased dramatically from 1993 to 1996, something like an increase of 43%. And Mexico has now replaced Japan as the third largest trading partner with the United States. Unemployment in all of the countries has actually decreased and direct investment has increased. So I would say that NAFTA has been a great success. And in fact, I suppose one could say, looking at it from a regional point of view, that this is hopefully what this so-called globalization would bring to an ever-increasing universe. In other words, these regional agreements should be looked at, I think, as stepping stones to, to a more global arrangement, so that there will not be excluded countries, that there will not be on the margin.
Despite the glowing report card that Donald Johnston and many others give NAFTA, numerous critics believe it's been a disaster. Maud Barlow is one of the critics. She's chairperson of the Council of Canadians, a grassroots organization that led the battle against NAFTA and its predecessor, the Free Trade Agreement.
What free trade did was improve the health of about 200 corporations that work across the border in North America and improve the investment opportunities for some of the people who are able to invest in those companies. So yes, there's no question, some people did just fine. It was not fine for the 58% increase in child poverty, the children who are caught in that stat, since the Canada-US free trade was signed. That's the statistic. It is not good for all the people who have had their hospitals closed down and their schools underfunded because we suddenly have no more public funding for social programs in this country. It's not good for the seniors who've seen $8 billion come out of the pensions in the last 5 years. It is not good for the environment where we have seen cuts of two-thirds for support for natural resource protection at the federal level, and between a half and two-thirds in most of the provinces across the country. It's not good for the animals, not good for the forest, it's not good for our water protection. It's good for the mining companies, it's good for some of the forestry companies, it's good for American transnationals and their subsidiaries here, yes. So I think the question is, who are you speaking for? And that's the reality of economic globalization, is if you're on the winning end, it looks grand. This system has created winners and losers, and this analysis that says that free trade has worked is an analysis coming from the winners.
NAFTA, we were told, would bring prosperity, jobs, and cheaper goods. But the agreement has had a profound impact on our social, cultural, and political lives. Take the environment, for example. We've spent years struggling to get better environmental standards. But Maud Barlow says trade agreements like NAFTA push them aside.
What it really comes down to is the agreement by governments that they are no longer going to establish standards on their own. Now, a lot of us don't have problems with that if we would be talking about higher standards. But what happens is that these trade agreements take precedence over international environmental agreements that are signed because they have enforcement measures that the environmental agreements do not have. And so the untold story to date about the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement, the GATT, the NAFTA, of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the World Trade Organization, is that it is an attempt to lock in environmental standards, at least where they are now, to roll them back in some of the countries where they have attained too high a standard for transnational corporations, and to establish international environmental arenas where global standards are set. But these are peopled by the corporations, and therefore when they talk about standards, they're not standards that many of us would consider acceptable. In fact, they're never what most of us would consider acceptable. We're basically entering a period that some of us are calling corporate rule, where transnational corporations have replaced nation states in terms of setting the dominant standards around everything from social programs to health and safety standards to the environment. And they are using international agreements to cement their rights in international law over nation states.
How did companies acquire the power to override the laws and regulations of sovereign states? John Cavanna, co-director of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., thinks it's been a gradual process.
I think the major problem in the world today is that companies, which 100 years ago were local and served primarily local markets, they employed local people, they were the pillars of the local tax base, and they cared necessarily about the health of the community because that's where they got their sustenance. Those companies in most countries created national markets by the 1930s or 1940s. That's certainly true of most U.S. companies. They were integrated across the country. And in the last 25 years, most large companies have gone global. And yet, most people remain rooted to a place. Most workers do. And national governments, by their nature, have to worry about the social and economic well-being of people within a nation. So there are enormous problems that emerge when the most dynamic economic actors are global, think globally.
There are corporations that have become symbols of their countries. You say Sony, you think of Japan. You say Volvo, you think of Sweden. None is more quintessentially representative than General Motors in the United States. It has stood for what is good in America.
In 1952, the chairman of General Motors, which has long been the largest U.S. industrial company, testified before the U.S. Congress and uttered the famous, now famous words, "What is good for General Motors is good for the United States," and vice versa. At that time, you could make that argument. General Motors was employing over 1 million people. They had been a major force of racial integration in the United States. They'd brought quite a large number of black Americans into the workforce. They were a pillar of the U.S. tax base. So they were employing people, they were paying taxes. You could make that argument. And a lot of U.S. policy was geared towards making life easier for General Motors. It is now the case that General Motors, what is good for General Motors, is no longer necessarily good for the United States. General Motors thinks globally, and it cares about making cars cheaply and profitably using a global production base. And so more and more, unfortunately, the interests of large corporations, which I think 50 years ago you could say the interests of large U.S. companies were linked to the U.S. economy, they now no longer are. And that's creating enormous turmoil, social tensions, environmental problems, a mess.
One of the questions I get asked most often when I talk about the global economy is why would politicians favor the transnational corporations over the interests of their own country? After all, we elect them to look out for us. John Cavanna.
Corporations can say to governments, look, we still provide some jobs here. We still pay some taxes here. If you don't continue to give us the sort of rules that we want, the sort of corporate subsidies that we ask for, we can pick up more of our production and move it overseas. And so to a certain extent, governments are in a horrible bind of trying to create the incentives that keep corporations at least partially loyal to their national roots. It's a horrible game that governments play, and ultimately I think it's a game that they lose. I think the difficulty today is that politicians have not caught up with the changing global reality. Now, they haven't caught up for one very important self-interested reason, which is that politicians in most of the world are elected into office in increasingly expensive campaigns with corporate money. It's not in the interests of government leaders, as well as the congresses and parliaments of those countries, it's not in their personal interest to catch up with a global economy where the interests of large corporations now diverge substantially with the interests of countries.
Globalization means opening up markets, lowering trade barriers, becoming more competitive. Transnational corporations want the same rules to apply wherever they go to get what's often called a level playing field. But that presupposes that all countries are the same. John Kavanagh.
We're in a world of very unequal nations, rich nations, poor nations, countries like Canada with very strong union structures versus countries with no independent unions like China, countries that have strong social welfare states and programs, again like Canada, versus much of the world where that doesn't exist. This creates a beautiful atmosphere for large companies based in Canada or the United States or Western Europe to move production into poorer countries, countries like Mexico or Indonesia or China, where you can exploit workers, you can ignore environmental standards, you can press production costs way, way down, yet still get very high levels of quality, very high levels of productivity. That gives you enormous bargaining power to then go back to workers in Canada or the United States or Western Europe and say, look, we can make these products at one-tenth the cost somewhere else and still get same levels of productivity and quality. Why should we be paying you this much? Why should we be paying you these lavish healthcare benefits? And that dynamic is one which, in my country, the United States, has led to a stagnation or decline in real wages for 60 to 70% of the workforce over the last generation. There's been an enormous shift in power from workers to corporations with this advent of a global economy.
The global economy is managed by at least a dozen organizations which administer, fund, regulate, and police economic activity worldwide. You've heard of many of them. The big one is the WTO, the World Trade Organization. There's the World Bank. Then there are regional trade organizations like NAFTA and APEC and the European Union. They all add up to a new form of global government. Like any government, they have the power to enforce their rules. One of the oldest of these organizations is the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. It was founded in 1944 at an international conference in Bretton Woods, Maine. The idea was to establish a new post-war economic vision for the world. As the economies of Europe, North America, and Japan boomed, the IMF and World Bank turned their attention elsewhere. Development through economic growth was seen as a way to raise the third world out of poverty. In a pattern that was to be repeated again and again, the good intentions became something quite different. Michel Chossudovsky is an economist from the University of Ottawa. He's author of a book called The Globalization of Poverty.
Well, first of all, the IMF was created in 1944, the Bretton Woods Conference. It was supposed to be an international fund which would allow for exchange rates to be stable in the world economy, and it was part of the whole process of post-war reconstruction alongside the World Bank. The mandate of the IMF was exchange rate stability, the stability of exchange rates. And what happened is that over the years, the de facto mandate of the IMF changed dramatically. It started already in the late 70s to police country-level economic reforms, imposing very harsh conditions on these countries. Essentially, it was during the debt crisis when third world countries became heavily indebted, and they were indebted both to governments but also to private banks. And then the IMF came in, more or less representing the interests of creditors, and said, we will help you to reschedule your debt. We will give you certain facilities, etc. We will give you money, but you have to accept and implement a certain number of reforms. So essentially what happened is that the creditors of the state, using the IMF as their bureaucracy, started to impose a whole series of economic policy measures. And in many regards, these were very drastic reforms.
In Africa, South America, and Asia, governments had been encouraged to exploit raw materials and grow cash crops like coffee with generous loans from the World Bank. By the 1970s, third world debt had become enormous, and interest payments alone crippling. At this point, the IMF came in to help get rid of their debt. Their solution was called structural adjustment, cutbacks in public health, education, the environment, and social services, and the dismantling of food and farm subsidies. Michel Chosadovsky.
In Rwanda, 90% of the population are farmers. They produced two types of commodities: food staples for their own survival and for sale in local markets, coffee for export. And what happened was when the IMF went into Rwanda, they said, you cannot subsidize coffee farmers, and you have to cut the price to the farmers. And what happened, which was very dramatic, the Rwandan farmer started to uproot coffee trees. He started to abandon coffee production because they couldn't cover their costs. And people would get into food farming as a substitute for cash crops. But simultaneously, the IMF and the World Bank imposed the deregulation of the grain market and the opening up of the national economy to the dumping of grain surpluses. So what happened was that the farmers couldn't produce coffee because the prices were too low and they couldn't cover their costs. But they couldn't produce food for themselves and for local sale in local markets because the IMF and the World Bank had imposed the dumping of grain surpluses. So what happened was that the entire agricultural system collapsed. The entire agricultural system collapsed. And this, I'm not saying that this was the cause of the civil war or the genocide, but people were in total despair. Their livelihood was destroyed. They were impoverished in a country where the standard of living is very, very low to start with.
Structural adjustments impose a costly burden on people who are already poor to begin with. But the promised benefits of greater free trade and economic growth haven't even brought food security to the poor nations. More trade is supposed to mean more food. Vandana Shiva is an activist for the Third World Network and an expert on food issues.
In June, we were told by the World Bank, your food stocks are high, you're spending too much money holding these stocks, sell your wheat. India sold 2 million tons of wheat. In December, obviously, we were short of wheat because we had sold the wheat that we were holding in stock for our own use, and India had to import wheat at a higher price. As far as trade figures are concerned, there's been a tremendous growth in trade. After all, 4 million tons of increased trade in wheat took place. And The pundits of free trade say this is 4 million tons more of wheat, but it's the same wheat going out and the same wheat coming in. Meantime, more peasants have become poorer and are eating less food. So if you look at the economy of food, people are worse off. You look at the economy of trade, you say 4 million tons of more wheat. And if you look at the discussions at the WTO, you look at the discussions undertaken by the global agribusiness, every one of them says more trade, more food. No, more trade can mean less food. Trade liberalization is creating a situation where more and more people are moving out of food production. More and more peasants are being made unviable. Agriculture is being pushed into growing shrimps and flowers for exports, not food. Add all that up together, you don't have more food. You have more food traded, but you don't have more food grown. You have less food grown and less food security overall.
Michel Chasudovsky.
I think we're in a period in history which is in many respects dramatic. I would say it's the most serious economic crisis in modern history. What has happened in Southeast Asia, for instance, Indonesia, Korea, Thailand, is an abrupt and rapid impoverishment of large sectors of the population in countries which in fact had achieved rapid progress in the post-war period. And what we are now seeing is that all the achievements of the post-war period in the developing countries, in other words, the post-colonial economic and social development process, is being dismantled. In other words, it is a process of recolonization, and there's no justification for these programs. They are destructive, they are deadly, they destroy people's livelihood, and ultimately they lead national economies down the drain.
You may wonder what economics and globalization have to do with the environment and human culture. But there's a strong connection. The environmental movement of the 60s and 70s grew out of a realization that human activity was adversely affecting our surroundings. So worldwide support grew to save whales and rhinos, stop rainforest destruction, and reduce pollution. But by the 90s, it had become clear that people who are starving are not going to care much about an endangered species, especially if it's edible. Those who are oppressed, poor, or have no security in their lives have other priorities than protecting the environment. So the effect of economics and globalization on the world's people is central to environmental issues. Ethyl Corporation is an American company that introduced lead to gasoline as a means of increasing octane to get better combustion. But lead proved to be a dangerous pollutant and was eventually banned from gas. Ethyl Corporation switched to a manganese-based compound called MMT. Manganese is a neurotoxin that can attack the brain and induce Parkinson's-like tremors. Car manufacturers complain that MMT gums up engines. Many refineries have refused to work with it. Several American states have banned it. In Canada, MMT was allowed in gasoline, but objections to its use mounted until in June 1997, after a parliamentary debate, MMT was banned. Ethyl Corporation used Chapter 11 of NAFTA to say this was a restraint on free trade and a smear on their reputation. They sued the Canadian government for $350 million. The Canadian government made an out-of-court settlement with Ethyl Corporation in June 1998. Canada paid the company a penalty of $19.2 million, rescinded its ban on MMT, and issued a statement that there was no evidence that MMT is hazardous. This is an example of how the rules of free trade can override the sovereignty of national governments. The Ethel case has far-reaching implications. Maud Barlow of the Council of Canadians.
So what we are so fearful about, and the terrible precedent that the Ethel case has set, is that governments are going to negotiate before they get to these trade tribunals with these corporations so that it doesn't become public. We call it the chill effect. And what will happen is either governments will no longer even contemplate in certain legislation because they will be told by the industry sector, well, we've had our auditors and our accountants do an assessment and we think it'll cost you $1 billion to do this. You'll have to pay us. Well, many governments, rather than face that kind of payment or the humiliation of the public knowing about it, will do either back off the legislation or, if there's sufficient pressure in the community, pay off the corporation when no one's looking. So you'll find taxpayers in Canada and other countries paying transnational corporations for the right for their governments to implement legislation that they voted them in for.
Global trade has vast implications for the environment. Environmental regulations have been enacted in a helter-skelter way from country to country. As trade is liberalized, corporate demands often come into conflict with local regulations. So, there's a move to level the playing field. The World Trade Organization is the final arbiter of all trade disputes. And that's where important decisions will be made about global environmental standards. The laws of individual countries will have to fall into line. Maud Barlow.
One example is under the World Trade Organization, where several very important American laws have been knocked down. Laws which, for instance, banned the sale of tuna that was caught in drift nets that catch dolphins. Mexico challenged that to ruling under the World Trade Organization successfully. Another was a recent case to protect sea turtles, rare sea turtles, from drift net fishing that catch shrimp in Southeast Asia. Again, that's been knocked down through the World Trade Organization. The way it works is that they use what's called the principle of the product as you see it. In other words, tomato is a tomato is a tomato, tuna is tuna is tuna. It doesn't matter how it was grown or caught or what humane or inhumane practices were used in the production or the sale or the environmental conditions under which that was grown. What happens is that if it's what's called a like product in the end, that's all you're allowed to look at, and it's a trade sanction otherwise.
The proponents of free trade argue that the environment is protected in the global economy. The case for dolphin-free tuna may have been lost, but the WTO is there to consider the merits of each case. In principle, this should protect the interests of local regions and countries. So what is the WTO's track record on environmental issues? Elizabeth May is a lawyer. She also heads the Sierra Club of Canada.
There has never been a domestic environmental protection regulation that's gone before the World Trade Organization panel on a challenge and survived. Every single time an environmental regulation has been challenged in a trade dispute before the WTO, the environmental regulation has been struck down. And when you look at the composition of the trade panels, you realize why. None of the people who sit as judge and jury at the WTO have any knowledge of environmental or health issues. All they know is the doctrine of trade liberalization. It's a very effective cadre of people who have a very complete and reassuring ideology that trade liberalization will lead us to a better world. Honestly, I've met some of these people. They're not evil. They really believe in the mantra that trade liberalization will lead us to a better world. It could, but not the way they're doing it.
Some may argue that the globalization juggernaut must be stopped in its tracks. Elizabeth May believes there is a way to bring the world economy into balance with the environment.
The best way, I think, to address this imbalance between the unspoken rights of all living beings, like forests and the creatures of the oceans, is to have global clout for all the other rights that have been abandoned at the nation state level. So we need a global institution as powerful as the WTO that's a world environment organization. We need global standards. I'm not against either globalization or free trade. I'm desperately against the way it's being forced upon us now. But there's no reason, there's no logical reason that you couldn't construct a system where expanding trade and expanding globalization meant that every country had to meet the highest standards of anyone else within that trading system.
Globalization, as it now operates, is eroding the ability of governments and citizens to freely make decisions about the welfare of their countries. It's destroying the public sector itself, the social commons, the glue that has kept our societies together. In 1997 alone, $167 billion worth of public assets around the world were transferred to the private sector. Prisons, hospitals, roads, and schools. And that's not all. Maud Barlow.
The essence of globalization is the assault on everything left standing in the public sector everywhere in the world, from social programs to public education to the protection of the environment to the notion that this river belongs to the people who live on it and fish it, to the notion that the air that we breathe is common property, to the notion that knowledge is our common heritage, the genetic inheritance of the developing world belongs to the people who live in it, who cultivate it. This notion is under profound assault. And I think Canadians and citizens around the world are going to have to up the movement that we have started to directly confront this corporate role, because our governments are not doing it any longer on our behalf at all.
But if governments aren't looking after our interests, who will? David Corton has a PhD from Stanford and taught for many years at the Harvard Business School. He was an enthusiastic believer in the benefits of international aid programs and economic growth. But he saw firsthand that in many poor countries, they didn't work. Recently, he's written a book called When Corporations Rule the World.
To me, the fundamental principle is that these seemingly overwhelmingly powerful institutions have only one source of power. It's the power that we as people yield to them. They're all human institutions. And in a sense, they exist only in our mind. And the extent to which we accept them as legitimate and yield to them as legitimate institutions. If we withdraw that legitimacy and withdraw that power, they almost literally no longer exist. I mean, it's like the fall of the Soviet Union, when people finally got their act together and said, you know, this institution is not serving us, it's not legitimate, it collapsed in an instant. Now, there's no question in my mind that we're seeing a massive shift in consciousness among people all around the world. Somehow, you know, the system has really overstepped with this press toward globalization, because now the consequences are breaking out in ways that people can see, and they can see the connections between the trade agreements and more people losing their jobs and labor unions having a harder time maintaining wages and, you know, the egregious environmental abuses and so forth, and also the just absolutely wanton disregard by the power holders for the needs of the mass of the population. So this is building a new consciousness.
John Kavanagh of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C.
The key here is that governments have been getting all of the pressure from corporations. Corporations have been giving them the money to be elected, and they've been saying, in return, we want new rules. We want a World Trade Organization. We want a NAFTA. We now want NAFTA expansion to the rest of the hemisphere. Governments have not been getting enough of a backlash from citizens groups saying, absolutely not. You can't give this away. Governments, after all, respond to pressure, and they've been responding overwhelmingly to corporate pressure and corporate money. And again, here's a piece of good news. There is a growing citizen backlash in Canada, in the United States, and in many parts of the world where people are standing up and saying, this incredible accelerated push towards corporate globalization is not in our interests, and we're not going to let you get away with it.
Donald Johnston, Secretary General of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, believes in the unquestioned benefits of globalization.
Here at the OECD, I brought with me the concept I had in government, is that what one has to do is maximize economic growth, because without that you cannot have social progress. But you also have to have social cohesion and social stability, so the benefits of economic growth have to be transferred in an equitable way to populations at large. And the agency for doing that is good governance. And it's these three together, essentially, which make societies progress. And when any one of them breaks down, countries and societies come to a halt. And that domestic triangle, if you like, is now international. And we have to ensure that the benefits of the trade and liberalization of investment agenda and the benefits it's clearly providing are equitably distributed on a global basis. And that has not happened yet. And this triangle is often out of balance, as it clearly is globally, with 1.2 billion people currently living in poverty, abject poverty for that matter. So this is the great challenge, and governance is central to it.
Maud Barlow believes the current global institutions do not ensure the balance Johnston hopes for. She thinks that they have to be rebuilt.
We have to defeat and stop these international agreements, and we have to build international systems and codes and processes that will create truly international standards. I am not a nationalist in that sense, and I would easily give away a great deal of sovereignty in this country for higher economic, social, environmental standards around the world for everyone. And that's got to be the goal, and there is a great deal of work being done now on how that could happen, how governments could work to cut off tax havens for corporations, how they could work together to establish higher standards in terms of these global agreements, how you could build a multilateral agreement on investment that gave citizens and governments and NGOs fundamental rights and not just corporations' rights. What would it look like if we said that we would revoke the licenses of corporations who pollute or who use child labor and so on? There are a thousand ways that we as citizens of the world can start to talk about how we are going to bring the rule of law to global capital. But if we don't bring the rule of law to global capital, we cannot save the environment. We cannot save the earth. We cannot. And unless we turn to and address the systemic undermining of our democratic ability to do anything about that through these international trade agreements, through globalization, through privatization, through deregulation, unless we address that, you're sitting in that boat, taking your little thimble, and you're going to drown.
I travel a lot, too much. Stepping from a plane in Shanghai, Moscow, or Buenos Aires, I'm always struck by how familiar the airport feels. The same shops, same computers, and same consumer products. That's what a global economy does. In Papua New Guinea, the Amazon, and Nairobi, I've seen children running around in Nikes, dancing to Madonna or Michael Jackson, and watching Baywatch on TV. Again, the consequence of globalization. We are spreading a single notion of progress and development to the farthest reaches of the earth. But one of the great discoveries in biology this century has been the importance of diversity for long-term survival. By maintaining a tremendous variety of genes, species, and ecosystems, life has always been able to overcome the unexpected changes that keep occurring on this planet. Diverse cultures have given us the same kind of protection. It is the differences that ensure that there will be survivors, that make life adaptable and resilient. Uniformity or monoculture runs counter to this basic principle and makes us vulnerable to sudden changes. We are performing a huge experiment by pushing one kind of economics around the world. What if it's a mistake?